MacIver seemed to know more than he was willing to say as he greeted Valentine at the farm office. Out back, a feed truck clattered as the winter's stores were transferred to the silo. A group of hands ate sack lunches on the porch.
Heard you had a good time after, at the dance, Buck.
A lively night. Where you want me today?
You can have the afternoon off. Be back for the evening milking. Let the machines do the titty pulling for a change.
As Valentine left, another hand turned to one of his lunchmates, a big pile driver of a man named Ski.
I give him a month.
He's colored, and a grog fucker to boot. She'll keep him around to show off to the other doctors at the holiday parties. He'll get his dismissal papers right before New Year's.
Valentine seethed. He took a walk to let the anger bleed off. Valentine found Anka scooping grain. The golden one was alone, and the cascade of grain going onto the conveyor as it went up to the silo gave a lot of covering noise. He hopped up on the side of the truck. To his credit, Anka didn't miss a stroke with the shovel.
I met a doctor last night and got inside the towers. I saw Gale.
I knew this would be the end of the trail. I am surprised he is still alive.
Give me that. You shouldn't be pushing.
Anka passed him the shovel. It felt good to move the mix of corn and feed grain.
This is some kind of baby factory. I've heard stories of women otherwise unemployable just being warehoused while they gestate. Once they recover, they go through it all over again.
And why all the security?
Remember the ranch? The Currians might be tinkering with the fetuses. I've wondered why they don't make their own versions of bears.
Too hard to control, perhaps. My David, where were you born?
The lakes in the North Woods, you know that.
But do you? You told me before it was a strange childhood. Never seriously ill, never a broken bone, healing from cuts overnight.
Bear blood passed down, like Stiakowski. If someone was breeding a more pliable human, it didn't take.
Fran Paoli continued to see him on her strange schedule as the weather turned sharply colder. He and Fran saw each other strictly on her terms, and she would tear up the roads in her big Lincoln to get them to a show in Cleveland and then back down again. Valentine never asked her about putting him to work in the towers. He never asked her for so much as a ham sandwich. She bought him two sets of clothes, a fine material suit with a double-breasted jacket. He feigned ignorance with the necktie knot, since the only one he really knew how to make was the tight Southern Command military style, and some casual slate-colored pants with a taupe turtleneck, made of an incredibly soft and lightweight material she called cashmere. She observed the results when he put it on and stood in front of the frame-length mirror in the corner of her bedroom.
You need more than cash to get that these days. You need connections.
My whole life I've never had a connection.
Which is why you're milking cows. I'm not even that great of a doctor, but I'm running a whole department here thanks to connections I've made. Why haven't you asked me for a better job? Every guy I've dated wants me to set him up in an office.
You're not like any woman I've ever known, Fran. I didn't want you to think I was, what did Oriana call it, after your status?
You're so young. A brass ring won't just fall into your lap, you know. You're smart. Haven't you figured out that you need to be angling for job security?
Well, if I don't like it in the ordnance, I'll just go back to Kentucky. Or sign on as an officer in a grog unit.
That's a waste. Any stump tooth can fill out requisition forms for grog infantry. You need to get yourself into a field Kerr needs. Something not just anyone can do. That's why I chose obstetrics. Kerr looks 10,000 years into the future, and about the only certainty is that you need babies to get there.
The kind of education I have doesn't lend itself to medical school.
There's nursing. You could put in a year here, then go off to Cleveland or Pittsburgh for classroom work.
You could arrange that.
I'll speak to the director. Be right back.
She turned her back to him, then turned around again and sat on the bed. She patted the spot next to her.
She said you might fit an opening. Let's do a follow-up interview to be sure.
Valentine managed to wheedle a job for Anka out of it as well. Anka went to work in the laundry of the main hospital building. The amount of clothing and linen generated by the hospital and the four grands was formidable. Anka discovered two other well-trained grogs, the simpler gray ones, working in the bowels of the hospital, also filling and emptying the washers. They left the grotty little hand housing and moved into the cleaner but smaller apartments for the service workers. The housing warden showed Valentine his new quarters. He carried an assortment of tools at his belt and a long-hosed can of bug spray in a hip holster.
Less than 2 weeks in Xanadu, and already you're improved. I want your grog to shower outside, though, or you're out of here. He can use the hose. First sign of fleas, and you're out of here.
The room had a phone, and even more amazingly, it functioned. Valentine couldn't remember the last time he'd stayed in a room with a working phone. They put Valentine to work in the South Grand to begin. His nursing duties involved bringing food and emptying the occasional urine bottle and endless tubes of breast milk. He learned a little more of the baby factory routine. The women had their children at an appointed date and time, always by cesarean. Up until that time, they were two to a room, with high cubicle walls in between, giving the illusion of individual apartments. After giving birth, they were rotated to a new building and given a new room. If they hadn't had a window before, they got one the next time. Each room had a single television. A modicum of deal-making took place, having to do with television choice and the window side of the room. The television had four channels. Channel 3 exhibited a parade of tawdry dramas, including the staple Noonside Passions. Would Ted turn Holly in to gain the brass ring he'd so long wanted, though he did not yet know she was carrying his child? And would her sister Nichelle ever get out of the handsome yet despicable black marketeer Brick's webs? Valentine worked four floors in his new blue scrubs, madly during mealtimes, slowly at other hours. His charges were all in their second trimester. Though the women looked wan and drawn thanks to their pregnancies, they were cheerful and talkative, or spent long hours on sewing projects for ordnance soldiers. Rumor had it the semen that fertilized them came from decorated combat veterans. He wondered if Melita Karaska had been this upbeat during her pregnancy. He wondered at the weight loss. The mothers-to-be he'd met over the years had mostly put on weight. Another nurse, an older woman with years of experience, took him into her confidence as she lit up in the emergency exit stairway, the unofficial smoking lounge. Valentine had taken to carrying cigarettes and even smoking one now and again. It was the easiest excuse to get away from his duties for a few minutes.
It's the quick succession of pregnancies. They have six, and then they can retire to the Ontario Lakeshore and run a sewing circle or a craft workshop. Nice little payoff, but hell on the body while you're cranking them out.
The hefty nurse who counted off meals as they went on Valentine's cart also confided to him. She was his immediate supervisor for mealtime duties.
Diet, Tar. These doctors are all protein happy, throwing pregnant women into ketosis. Protein, fats, fiber, and more protein is all they get. And enough iron for a suit of armor. Liver, onions, supplements.
Gets results. They're happy enough.
That's the medication talking. Every woman here is buzzier than a beehive.
Valentine got a chance to test his supervisor's opinion the next day. Every time he got a chance, Valentine looked out one of the windows facing the patio area and the greenhouse below, trying to get a feel for the rhythm of Gail Foster's schedule. Other than a trip to the pool every other day, she never seemed to join the other groups of pink mothers-to-be. He wondered if there was a reason for that. Then one day, as he served lunch, he saw her again, sitting at a table with a book open before her. She had one of the thick white robes around her body and a towel around her neck. Valentine finished passing out his meals to the women who ordered food delivered to their rooms, most ate on the second floor in the cafeteria, and then hurried to the elevator and went outside, ostensibly for a smoke. Gail Foster sat wrapped up in her book and white terry cloth. He tried to read the title, but it was in a cursive script hard to see at a distance. He walked up at an angle, getting out of the mild fall breeze so he could strike a match. The smell of the match lighting reminded him of that long-ago escape from Chicago's zoo. It looked like the elaborate cursive script of her book read, "A Dinner of Onions," but Valentine couldn't be sure. Gail studied the pages before turning, as though she had to learn the first chapter for a test.
Good book?
She didn't respond. Valentine watched her eyes. When she got to the bottom of the right-facing page, instead of turning it, she went back up to the top of the left-side page again. Was she memorizing the novel?
Not many patients here like to read.
Valentine took another step forward, blocking her light.
What's it about?
She turned and looked up at him.
I'm sorry?
Your book, what's it about?
Some people. I don't know.
You feeling all right?
Very well. Doctor says I'm doing very well, but I need some sun, you see?
Your accent, where are you from?
Down south.
You ever want to go back?
Back where?
Down south.
No. I have to stay here so the baby can come. It's part of being a healthy mom. There are four parts to being a healthy mom. Did you know? Diet, exercise, care, and attitude. I had to work on my attitude, most of all. But it's much better now.
Obviously. You ever wish you could be with your child after it's born?
Oh, no. Our children go to special schools. They learn from the very first weeks how to lead mankind out of darkness. The long march to the future. It would be selfish of me to want to keep my baby from that. That would be a very bad attitude to have.
Absolutely.
Valentine finished his cigarette. Post had once told him that he and Gail had their falling out over an abortion. She did not want to bring a child into the world just to be disposed of at some future date by the Kurian Order. Was there anything left of that woman? Cooperation from Gail would make all the difference in the world. During daylight hours, the women were free to visit their outdoor patio or even a strip of park bordering the North Tower. But how to get cooperation from a woman who had to think long and hard over whether she'd finished a page in her novel or not, and what action to take about it once she did? Anka conferred with Valentine as the days began to run out in October. There was frost on the ground most mornings now.
We need someone who can drive. Drive really well.
That might be doable. You think we could trust the doc?
Your lover? No,
I mean Dr. Booth. I've seen her with pickups and that little ATV. She says she hates people. Maybe she means she hates the system.
She is risk-averse. She does her job, wraps herself in it like a cloak, my David.
And there's one bit of skin showing. That assistant of hers, Pepsa, she's protecting her, hiding her. I wonder if she'd get her out with us.
And why are we leaving?
I'll come up with a reason.
There's a little Halloween party tomorrow night at the top floor of Grand North.
I might be working.
I'll get you off.
Undoubtedly. But I don't know that I should miss any shifts. I think I have to keep my nose clean here for a while. If they even let me keep my job. Otherwise, it's back to Kentucky.
Let me worry about your reputation. And your job. Besides, it's going to be a fun party. North has this beautiful function space, and even Oriana is going to get dressed up.
I don't have a costume.
Yes, you do. That biker getup of yours. I've been working on something to match all those spikes.
Easily done.
You nap. I have to get back to the wards. I'm missing an operation.
Dr. Booth came to her surgery door.
Ayub?
Can I come in?
It's 11 at night.
It's important enough.
Booth brought Valentine into the tiled surgery and turned on a light.
What's so important now?
I'm leaving the ordinance, going back to Kentucky.
Good for you.
I was wondering if your assistant might like to come. Anyone with veterinary training would be welcome there.
Pepsa? A rabbit run? Why should she do that?
Well, she's mute. I'm surprised she hasn't been culled out of the herd before this.
How dare...
Just cutting through the bullshit, Booth. Are you the type who only likes to see half the truth? I know people. We get her somewhere safe from the Reapers. A lot safer than your dog kennels and dairy stalls.
We?
Me, Anka, you. Someone on the outside. I don't want to say more.
You just offered up your heart. You know that? You'd be gone tonight if I told security. I get a seat at the head tail at the next Ordnance Gratitude Banquet.
If you're such a friend of security, why haven't our guns ever left your office? Or have they?
She couldn't help but look over her shoulder at the corridor to her storage room.
You could come along. Disappear into the tribe lands or relocate into free territory.
Free territory's a myth. Some clearing full of gorillas does not a nation make.
I've been there.
As if it's that easy.
I didn't say anything about it being easy.
Let me talk to Pepsa.
Valentine followed her with his ears and listened from the surgery doorway as she went into a back room and spoke to Pepsa. Valentine couldn't see what Pepsa communicated back on her kitty magic tablet. This would be an all-or-nothing gamble. Every person added to a conspiracy doubled the risk. Dr. Booth, with Pepsa trailing behind in a robe, joined him in the surgery. Pepsa looked at him with new interest in her gentle eyes.
You have people who can help us get all the way to the free territory?
There are plenty of animals to take care of there. Herds of horses.
Pepsa wrote something on her board.
But you have people outside Xanadu to help us get away?
Absolutely.
Booth and Pepsa exchanged a look. Pepsa wrote again.
What do you need us to do?
Well, we need some food that can be preserved. Pack some cold weather clothing and camp mats and have it all ready by tomorrow afternoon. Make some excuse for not being available until November 1st or 2nd. And one more thing. I need a quick look in your pharmacy.
Valentine walked all the way back to the rec center to use the phone there. He could have used the phone in Booth's office, but just in case she or Pepsa turned on him, he could warn Duvalier.
Yeah?
Valentine asked to speak to Duvalier's Ordnance ID pseudonym.
No calls after 9.
It's urgent. Could I leave a message?
She'll get it in the morning, Corporal.
The attendant must have thought Valentine was Duvalier's would-be boyfriend, Corporal Thatcher.
Well, tell her my migraine is back. I'll come by tomorrow night, then we can get to the party.
Migraine?
M-I-G-R-A-I-N.
She'll get the message at a decent hour. Reread your phone protocols, Corporal. Dayton doesn't give you special privileges to disturb me.
Well, tell her some new friends will be along. We have transport.
I am not a stenographer, son. Call her tomorrow.
I will. Thanks.
Next, he'd have to wake on Ka. He looked at the craft table with the Halloween costumes. Xanadu had its share of children, and while it was still light out, they paraded around in their costumes from building to building, collecting treats from the security staff at the doors. The kids sang as they collected their candy. A reaper, a creeper, goes looking for a sleeper, waves him up, drinks him down, and packs him in the freezer. Valentine, dressed in his bulletproof leathers and carrying a large brown market bag full of costuming, was a little shocked to hear the realities of life in the Kurian Zone expressed in nursery rhyme fashion. He watched one young child, dressed in the red and white stripes of a frightening, bloody-handed Uncle Sam, pull his cowgirl sister along as they sang. He'd been at sea during his other Halloween in the Kurian Zone, so he couldn't say if it was a widespread practice. Or maybe on this one night, mention of the real duties of the Reapers was allowed. Valentine passed into Grand East and nodded to the security staff. They were used to him by now.
Nice costume, Tar. You really rode those things?
Sure did.
Valentine went to the smaller of the elevators, the one that went to the top and garage floors, and rode up. He couldn't help but pat the syringes stuck in the breast of his legworm rider jacket. His .22 target pistol was tucked into the small of his back, held in place by 3 strips of surgical tape. Hopefully, he wouldn't need it.
Come in.
He hurried in, wondering just how, and he had his answer when he saw her. She stood in the doorway of her bedroom, a gothic queen spider in thigh-high boots, thick with buckles. Black eyeliner, spider earrings, and a temporary tattoo of a skull on one fleshy corset-enclosed breast.
Sticks and stones may break my bones, but leather and chains excite me.
What on earth do you use boots like that for?
Turning men on. Is it working?
I'll say. Come here, you naughty girl.
She tested the hooks on his forearms and looked down at the spurs.
Well, you're dangerous tonight.
You've no idea.
He sat on the arm of her sofa and threw her across his knee, raising the torn, black-dyed taffeta miniskirt. A black thong divided her buttocks. He gave her backside an experimental slap.
Ooh!
I may just have to tie you up so other men don't get a chance to see this.
Nothing I could do about it. Oh, my, what a strong arm you have.
She lifted her now splotched buttocks a little. Valentine extracted the syringe from his jacket, pulled the plastic cap off with his teeth, and held it in his mouth while he spanked her again, even harder. He transferred the syringe to his hand and injected her, threw it across the room behind her, and struck her again. Six more swats, and she was limp. The large animal tranquilizers had their effect. She tried to caress him as he transferred her to the bedroom. He kissed her several times, then gagged her with her bathrobe belt and tied her up in the closet using pairs of pantyhose and leather belts. She offered no resistance, save a dopey-eyed wink.
Now you just wait there for a little while.
He kissed her on the forehead. Valentine shut the closet door. He took the keys from the dresser and her blue ID card. He pocketed them and rode the elevator to the basement. He'd worked out every move in his mind. Gone over it so many times, a sense of unreality persisted. Was he still lying in bed, planning this? Was it his real hand reaching for the big Lincoln's door, his bag he placed on the passenger seat, his foot on the accelerator as he backed toward the fuel pump? He topped off the tank and filled the two spare 20-liter plastic containers she kept in the back. Valentine climbed into the driver's seat and put on the seatbelt and comm headset. He started the SUV and turned it toward the garage door. He pressed the comm button on the dash and spoke into her mouthpiece.
216, leaving.
Dr. Paoli?
Tar Ayub, running an errand.
216, leaving. Enjoy the party.
Valentine pulled the SUV around to the West Tower, parked it in plain sight under a roadside light, and trotted over to the basement door with his bag. Anka, in his laundry overcoat, opened the door.
Here.
He passed Valentine some blue scrubs. The boots looked a little funny under them, but he'd pass. Once Anka checked the basement hallway, thick with conduits and junction boxes, Valentine went to the larger, gurney-sized elevators and pressed the up button. Anka brought a wheelchair out from around a corner. They were easily found all over the building, but it never hurt to be prepared. He pushed Fran's blue card in the slot and went up to the fourth floor. Halloween decorations, traditional orange and black paper, festooned the hallway over the honor in childbearing propaganda. Valentine walked behind the wheelchair to the common room. Vacant, tired eyes reflected the sparkling special effects on the TV. Gail Foster sat upright in the middle of the room. A nurse popped up at the door.
Can I help?
Gail Foster? Follow-up x-ray.
Follow-up to what?
Not sure. Dr. Kremmel's orders. They should have called. She wants it taken tonight.
That one.
The nurse pointed at Gail. Valentine went to her and tapped her on the shoulder.
Gail, I need you for a moment.
Sure.
Valentine helped her to the chair by the door. A few of the other patients exchanged looks, but most watched the movie. The nurse who had questioned Valentine was at the center console, speaking into the phone. No choice. He wheeled Gail to the station. The nurse turned to watch him.
Is there a problem?
Just checking with Central.
Should I wait?
If you don't mind.
She turned and checked the clipboard again. Valentine hated to do it, but he took out the horse tranquilizer. With one quick step, he got behind her and jammed it into her neck. He pulled her down, one hand on her mouth, and waited until her legs quit kicking.
He certainly got her cooperation.
Let's not have any attitude tonight, okay, Gail?
Valentine pulled the nurse into a file room. He found a length of surgical tubing and tied the door shut.
Woo! Yee-haw!
Gail was almost giddy as he raced her down the hall to the elevator. On the ride down, he stripped off his scrubs. When they reached the basement corridor, Anka helped Gail get dressed.
I've never been here before.
Valentine slipped a feathered mask on her.
Oh, pretty.
They walked her out to the Lincoln, Anka half carrying her across the road. The Golden One climbed in the back cargo area where his disassembled puddler waited, along with Valentine's weapons.
Keep her quiet back there and out of sight.
Valentine drove the Lincoln around the building perimeter to the veterinary office. Dr. Booth slipped into the passenger seat, and Pepsa climbed in back.
Glad you remembered the heavy coat.
You give good instruction. Is this Paoli's rig?
I like to make a grand exit.
Pepsa's eyes widened as she saw Anka in back. Valentine passed out masks to Dr. Booth and Pepsa.
Just on our way to a party, okay? Once we're past the gate, you'll be driving.
As they rolled around the hospital, the headlights illuminated a figure at the roadside in harsh black and white, gleam and shadow. A pale face, exaggerated and immobile as a theatrical mask, held them like a spotlight. A Reaper. Valentine's heart gave a triple thump. The Reaper could upend the Lincoln as easily as it might lift a wheelbarrow. Then what chance would they have, still within Xanadu's walls? If it moved, he'd have to, but it didn't. After they passed, it crossed the road behind them. How could it not know they had an expectant mother inside the SUV? Of all forms of life sign, a pregnant woman's was the strongest, and Valentine had one experience involving a Kurian and an infant's life sign that he'd rather die than repeat. Perhaps the Kurian animating it was sick or sated, or someone was letting them go. The gate warden hardly looked at them as they followed a bus full of Halloween partygoers out of Xanadu. Anka lay flat in the back cargo space, holding down Gail Foster. The sergeant smiled at them when they briefly stopped.
Have a good time, Dr. Paoli.
Valentine nodded, and Booth waved in return. Pepsa tapped her hands against the leather seats as Valentine pulled away from the gate.
We've done it!
We've done it, all right. Now what are they gonna do about it?
Valentine had switched places with Booth as soon as they passed out of the light of the gates. It was a cloudy evening, and the woods were black as a mine shaft. Only with wide-open cat eyes could he distinguish a tree trunk or two. He relaxed a little once they passed where he had sensed the Reaper pickets on his reconnaissance and made it out of the hairpin turn gully. If Valentine had chosen a spot to ambush the big-framed Lincoln, it would have been there. Booth drove skillfully, just fast enough to choose the best way to negotiate the patched road without bouncing her passengers around too much. The rugged suspension on the truck helped. As they took the river road into town, Valentine saw what looked like bonfires in the hills on both sides of the river.
What's all this?
Hell night.
Meaning?
Kind of a tradition. Old empty houses get burned to the ground on Halloween night. Further out, it's grain silos and barns.
On this one night, the town sounded lively. People crisscrossed the streets, burning everything from road flares to candles in grimacing fanged pumpkins. They pulled up on the street leading to the NUC hostel. It too was burning. Firefighters and police fought the blaze with hoses.
Thought you said only abandoned buildings.
Booth stopped the SUV well away from the conflagration and its attending crowd.
Could be some drunk got carried away. I should see if anyone...
No, stay here.
He got out of the vehicle. A man in football padding sat on the curb, drinking from a bottle within a paper bag. Duvalier and a man in the shale-colored uniform of the ordnance, old USM model rifle over his shoulder and a duffel in his hand, ran across the street into the Lincoln.
You weren't kidding about transport. Tar, meet Corporal Scott Thatcher.
Valentine remembered him from the dance. Thatcher had a bony face, but everything was pleasantly enough arranged.
You sure about this?
I want out, sir. Passage all the way if it can be arranged.
Free territory.
Valentine didn't like it. The boy could win a nice position in the Kurian zone by turning them in. He was certainly armed heavily enough to take control of the escape, with a pistol at his hip, an assault rifle over his arm. On the other hand, an ordnance uniform, stripes, and knowledge of the region, assuming Thatcher could be trusted, would come in handy.
He's okay, Val. He knows the ground. I trust him. So can you.
We'll see.
Says the man who manages to come out the gates with three, count 'em, ladies and gentlemen, three women. New personal best?
You'll have to put your duffel up top. The rifle can go in back. Give me that pistol.
Thatcher passed him the weapons. Valentine handed the assault rifle back to Anka in the cargo bay. Valentine wondered how they'd all fit. Duvalier crouched in between the driver and passenger seats, next to Thatcher, with Valentine and Pepsa in the seats behind. They pulled away from the fire and the growing crowd. In the back, Anka assembled his puddler.
fire you're doing?
Yes, but it's just a diversion. In another half hour, the police headquarters is going to lose their fodder wagons and fuel depot.
I had a feeling you were more than just a boy heading home, Tar.
You thought of everything.
A girl has to keep busy.
But it's not the police we have to worry about. It's the ordnance.
West on the River Road.
Where are you planning to cross?
Route 10 Bridge, just a mile ahead here. Saw it when we were biking. It's a lot of traffic.
Yeah, because it's open to civilians. You'll get at least a flashlight sweep. Go up 5 more miles and cross at Ironton Road. That's an ordnance checkpoint. There's a Kentucky roadside popular with all of us up a ways there. It's better all around.
Well?
Ironton Road it is.
Duvalier gripped Thatcher's hand and nodded, but Valentine felt like it was a mistake. The old rusty trestle bridge had been blown up at some point. New girders and railroad ties had been cobbled together to close the gap. Booth slowed.
Don't worry, we've taken trucks over it.
Valentine checked the magazine of Thatcher's 9mm, then chambered around. A lighted guardhouse at the other end had a couple of uniformed men in it. The Lincoln's headlights revealed two chains running from either side of the bridge to a post in the center, more of a polite warning than a serious obstacle. Yellow reflective tape fluttered from the center of each length, looking like a dancing worm in the headlights' glare.
I'm supposed to be asleep now.
Oh, great. We have a med head.
Keep her quiet and back there.
Booth rolled down her window as they approached the checkpoint. She swerved into the left-hand lane to pull up to it.
Hey there, Cup.
Thatcher passed over an ID card. Valentine didn't know if Cup was ordnance slang or a nickname, but the man's shirt read Doorthistle.
5 and a lost grog, going to Boudreaux's. Back by sunup.
The sentry looked at the card, then placed his flashlight beam on Thatcher. Booth began to glance around, and Valentine stiffened. If he was on the ball, the sentry would notice the fight-or-flight tell. She was looking for a direction to run.
Ugh.
Valentine returned his hand to the butt of the pistol next to his thigh.
The line's up again. That was quick.
You going to unhook or what, Private? It's Halloween, and we need to raise some hell!
A soldier inside picked up the phone. The private went around to the center post and placed his hand on the chain.
Border closed! Alert!
Ram it!
Booth sat frozen, her hands locked on the steering wheel. The guard by the chain stepped back, fumbling for his rifle as the butt hit the post.
Christ, go!
Valentine opened his door and aimed his pistol through the gap at the white-faced guard, lit like a stage actor by the Lincoln's beams. The guard spun away, upended over the chain. The noise unfroze the gears in Booth's nervous system. She floored the accelerator. Lincoln hit the chain and bounced over something that might have been the post going down or might have been the guard. The Lincoln gained speed.
Turn the lights off! Don't give them a mortuary!
Bullets ripped into the back of the Lincoln. Ankov threw himself against the back of the seats, wrapping Gail Foster in one great arm and Pepsa in the other. Valentine felt the Lincoln head up a slight rise, then turn, putting precious distance, brush, and trees between them and the checkpoint.
Everyone okay?
Some glass cuts. Post's mate is hit in the foot. Let me get her shoe off.
Oh, I wanna go home.
I believe a toe is missing.
Pepsa nodded at Valentine.
Pepsa, take my bag. See what you can do.
Anka shifted to give her room to get in the back.
Glass cuts?
I fear it. Maybe more than that, my David.
Who's David?
Just drive, please.
I could go faster if I turn on the lights.
No!
Go left here. It's a good road.
Valentine, smelling blood, his stomach hurting as though he'd been mule-kicked, saw a distant patch of flame, a house burning over by the river. Somewhere, there were people dancing in firelight. Somewhere, reapers were asking questions. Booth made the turn, heading south.
My David, I saw headlights hit the clouds far back. I believe we are being followed.
Stop the car. I'll drive. Doc, check out on Ka. Do what you can for him.
Valentine got the sport utility vehicle moving as soon as he heard the back door close. Booth switched places with Pepsa in the cargo area. Anka kicked out a bullet-starred window. He could see farther than Booth and pushed the engine up past 40 miles an hour. They ate miles. Every now and then, the Lincoln hit a pothole. A flash blinded him.
You need help.
Watch the light back there.
Booth had been using a flashlight to look at Anka. Sudden increases in light gave him an instant headache. Valentine spotted a legworm trail, the distinctive rise and thick vegetation cutting across a field.
I'm gonna go off-road.
Thatcher pushed a button on the center console, engaging the four-wheel drive.
Slow down. They'll see tire marks otherwise.
Valentine applied the brake, felt the Lincoln change gears. Automatic transmission made a huge difference in driving effort. He turned onto the legworm trail. Any tree big enough to stop the Lincoln was avoided by the creature. The ground looked easier to the east, so he followed another legworm trail leading that way. He listened to the car, cutting through weeds and grasses.
I've done all I can. The external bleeding stopped. For now.
Valentine found another road, got on it, and took it for a mile until it intersected with one in even worse condition, but at least he was heading south.
We're still being followed. Looks like a motorcycle.
Valentine didn't need the confirmation. He felt them behind, a presence. The way you felt a thunderstorm long before its first rumble.
Stop the car, my David.
The Golden One hoisted his puddler, then waited until they could hear the motorcycle engine.
Cover your ears.
Oh!
Valentine watched the motorcycle light shift, wink out.
That'll learn him.
Valentine put the car in gear again. He watched the colon blink on the dashboard clock. Had all this happened in only 20 minutes? He pushed the Lincoln, daring himself to wreck it, locked on to a distance 100 yards in front of the car, as if watching for downed tree limbs was the be-all and end-all of his life. Which it might be if he struck a big enough object in the dark.
They're still behind. Gaining, it would appear. Perhaps they have Hummers.
Shouldn't have shot that poor cup. They wouldn't be after us like this otherwise. I bet there's a locator in this rig.
You people are crazy. They say I'm the one who causes problems. They must have never met you.
My David, I have a suggestion.
I don't want to hear it.
They are going to catch up with this truck, sooner or later. Would it not be better if we weren't all in it when they did?
Uncop!
Let him talk!
I cannot walk far. Let me lead them on a wild grog hunt. When they catch up, I will grunt and pretend that I am simple. They will think a trick has been played, that a poor dumb grog has been put at the wheel to lead them away.
Lots of grogs know how to drive. They're good at it.
4 minutes behind. I marked that hilltop.
Devalia began to fiddle with her explosive-packed spam cans, a detonator, and a fuse. She threw one out one side of the road, then the other went into the opposite ditch.
You'll have to get Royal Flush Lucky to take one of them out.
I'm not trying for that. I just want to fool them into thinking they've been ambushed.
Valentine drove past a burning barn, collapsed down to the foundation, and mostly sending up smoke by now. The Lincoln plunged into a thicket, and he had to slow down. He found another legworm track and cut off the road again, splashing through a stream. Then they were out into broken country again. Valentine found yet another farm service road running along a rounded, wooded hill. They were in real backcountry now. It would be dangerous to go off-road. Not that the roads in this part of Kentucky were much better.
Oh, they're still behind.
Enough, my David. Let me take the wheel.
Val, it's the only way.
All right, but I'm coming with you.
No! You must still see Gale back. I may be able to fool them. With you, there will be too many questions.
Valentine stopped the Lincoln in the middle of the road.
We have to hurry. Everyone out. Thatcher, don't forget your gun and duffel.
Anka climbed out the back and came around to the driver's door, helping himself stand up by putting his long right arm on the side of the Lincoln, puddler cradled in his left. He was a mess, his back peppered with bandages and streaked in blood, a thick dressing on the back of his fireplug-like thigh. Duvalier stopped before him.
Yeah.
Then stood on tiptoe to kiss one whiskered cheek. She looped her oversized canteen around the Golden One's neck.
I want this back, you hairy fuck. You hear me?
Anka murmured a few words into her ear.
Oh, dream on.
Valentine could only stand, tired and fighting his headache, fiddling with his gun. Would it be better for their pursuit to come upon all their bodies, stretched out next to the flaming Lincoln, perhaps with every dead hand posed with middle finger extended? Anka reclined the driver's seat all the way so he could squeeze up front. He tossed the puddler onto the passenger seat.
We'll meet another dawn, my David.
If we live to see another dawn.
If not, we'll meet in a far better place.
Good luck, old horse.
Valentine placed his forehead against Anka's, hugged him, felt the rough skin and the strangely silky hair on his upper back. Ankar squeezed the back of his neck, and the Lincoln drove away.
Off the road, fast!
Valentine picked a route up the hill, which kept him from staring after the receding Lincoln. The best friend Valentine ever had, or would ever have, left only a little blood on the road.
Thatcher, lead them up that hillside.
No!
Duvalier pulled the pregnant Gail Foster into the bush, opening a gap in the bramble with her walking stick. Dr. Booth and Pepsa followed her, Pepsa searching anxiously down the road for their pursuers. Valentine spotted one of Duvalier's spam cans, unopened and unwired, left in the center of the road.
Shit!
He picked it up. Valentine closed the gap in the brush behind them by forcing a few tree limbs down and limped after his party. Halfway up the hill, they froze and counted the pursuit. They saw the pursuit convoy crest another rise in the distance.
He did it!
They crested the hill, and thanks to its commanding view, Valentine went through Thatcher's inventory. He brought some good topographical maps of Kentucky, and between the two of them, they made a good guess as to where they were. Several lights could be seen between the hill and the northern horizon, but they were so distant, Valentine couldn't tell if they were electric or burning homes. Duvalier pointed southwest.
What do you suppose that is?
I don't see anything.
That's a legworm dog pile. Look at the tracks.
What, that hump down there? I saw three of them all tangled up once after a snowstorm.
Let's get off this ridge, take a closer look. Maybe some of their tribe is around.
Valentine pointed out a tree at the bottom of the hill and had Thatcher find a path toward it. Gail was tiring out, and Duvalier gave her the walking stick. Valentine hung back to check the rest spot and waved Duvalier over.
You dropped this in the road.
Valentine gave Duvalier back her can of explosive-filled meat. She looked at it, puzzled, and whipped her bag off her back. The wing locks were still clicked shut.
Then it jumped out on its own.
Someone left it?
Everyone was in a hurry to get out of the truck. Maybe it got kicked out in the confusion.
Let's not leave anything to luck, good or bad.
They caught up to the others at the bottom of the hill and walked out into the horseshoe-shaped flat with the legworm dog pile roughly in the center. Legworm trails crisscrossed the ground everywhere, but none looked or smelled fresh. Maybe their minders were on the other side of the valley. Gail collapsed.
My legs won't hold me up anymore.
Booth listened to her heart and breathing with her stethoscope.
She's healthy, just out of condition.
We can rest for a little while.
Then need came. Terrible need. Valentine felt them on the towering hill behind, moving like an angry swarm of bees. Reapers. They'd home in on the life sign. He had a pregnant woman, and bitter experience told him that the Kurians hungered for newborns like opiate addicts sought refined heroin. He might as well be running with a lit Roman candle, and that would be the end of them.
We're in trouble.
What?
No time.
Valentine handed Duvalier his rifle.
You and Thatcher head for those telephone poles. Doc, you and Pepsi go into those woods and find low ground. Lie flat as you can.
He tossed Thatcher's 9mm to Booth.
Reapers?
Coming down the hill. Hurry. I'll lead them off. Maybe I can lose them.
How?
Interference.
Price's critter camouflage, writ in 60-foot letters. Valentine took Gail's wrist and pulled her to her feet.
Oh, I hate this. I want to go to my room. Please. This endangers the baby.
He could feel them coming, but caution had slowed them, stalking lions reevaluating as the herd they'd been stalking scattered. Gail's legs gave out. Valentine picked her up in a fireman's carry, hoping it was safe to carry an expectant woman this way, and ran.
Those chain things sound like wind chimes. I like wind chimes. Are we going back to the Grand soon?
Very possible.
From 100 feet away, the legworm pile looked like a gigantic lemon pie with a lattice top crust, baked by a cook who was stoned to the gills. The legworms had pushed banks of earth up into walls, forming the pie tin, and had woven themselves at the top. Valentine reached the bank and climbed up it, sending dirt spilling. He went down on one knee and set Gail on churned up ground. They were coming again, after him, fast.
I don't want to run anymore.
Good. We need to crawl.
He pulled her beneath a smaller legworm's twisted body, back set to the elements, shaggy skin flapping in the wind like an old torn poster. They descended into the dark tangle and perceived a faint aqua glow from within. Valentine felt like he was back in the ruins of Little Rock, negotiating one of the great concrete and steel wrecks of a building downtown. Legworms lay on top of each other everywhere, a sleeping pile of yellow-fleshed pickup sticks. The air grew noticeably warmer as he pulled Gale deeper into the nest. The legworms were not packed as tightly at the bottom. Valentine felt air move. He followed it and the glow.
I don't like this.
Don't blame you.
The walls opened up, and they came upon the eggs. The legworm bodies arched above and around, making a warm arena for their deposits. About the size of a basketball, the eggs had translucent skin. The glow came from the growing legworm's underside. The soft membrane had blue filament-like etchings of light, transformed into aqua by the greenish liquid within the eggs.
Smells like old laundry in here.
Shh! Valentine saw deep pockmarks in the skins of the larger legworms at the center. The eggs must have dropped off. Black lumps, like unprocessed coal, lay scattered between the living eggs. Evidently, only a few eggs made it to whatever stage of the metamorphosis they now enjoyed. Stepping carefully, Valentine crossed the egg repository, hoping the baby legworms were giving off enough life sign to confuse the Reaper's senses. He heard, felt, sensed motion behind. A string of Reapers entered the egg chamber, clad in their dark, almost bulletproof robes, the first staring about as if to make sense of the small glows and vast shadows. Valentine shoved Gale toward an A-shaped arch in a legworm's midsection. She turned around to protest, and her big eyes grew even wider until they seemed to fill her face. She instinctively reached for Valentine, putting his body in between herself and the others. As one, six Reaper heads turned in their direction. Valentine drew his .22 target pistol. The lead Reaper dismissed the threat with a wave, a grotesque wigwag of its double-jointed elbow. It had a burn-scarred face, making its visage that of a badly formed wax mask. Valentine pointed the gun at Gale's head. The Reapers spread out, but came no closer. The leader addressed Valentine.
Keep calm, brother. No one need die tonight. But be warned. Hurt her, and we will peel off your skin and leave you raw and screaming.
He switched the sights of the pistol to the Reaper's yellow gimlet eye. Valentine tried to still his hand.
You believe you can stop me with that?
Not me.
He aimed at an egg, then switched targets. The bullets tore through the eggs and sent fluid flying, splattering the Reapers. The egg chamber suddenly smelled like old milk. Valentine stifled a gag. Evidently, Reapers didn't get nauseated or had poor noses. They just wiped at the fluid in disgust. All around, legworm digits twitched like fluttering eyelashes.
Come on!
Valentine dropped the empty gun as he ran, pulling Gale along behind. Tons of legworm righted itself, and he threw her under it. Valentine felt its legs on his back as he made it to the other side. Valentine drew his legworm goad, buried it in the back of one as it began to roll, and pulled Gale tight to him as they ended up on its back. The earthen bowl writhed with searching legworms. Valentine anchored one of his cargo hooks in the loose skin atop the legworm and looped a chain around Gale. Her white fingers gripped it, while the legworm's back rose and fell as it negotiated the lip of the crater. A Reaper flew through the air. Well, half of one. Its waist and legs were still on the ground. Another jumped atop the back of a moving legworm and ran toward them like the hero of a western on top of a train, arms out and reaching. Two legworm muzzles rose from either side, one catching it by the head and arms, the other by its waist.
Make a wish.
Gale shifted position so that she wasn't resting on her belly and witnessed the scene behind her. More legworms carefully stabbed down with their muzzles, lifted them covered with black goo and shreds of black cloth, then stabbed down again.
Help!
A bony, blue-veined Reaper hand gripped her leg, pulling her off the legworm. She clutched at Valentine and the securing chain. He shifted his grip on his legworm goad. Valentine brought down the crowbar-like shovel edge on the Reaper's head. Skin peeled back, revealing a black, goo-smeared skull. The Reaper made a sideways climb, more like a spider than a man. still pulling at Gale so hard that Valentine feared both she and the baby would be divided between the antagonists in Solomonic fashion. Valentine crossed the shimmying legworm back, jumping as the Reaper swung its free arm. He buried the goad in the forearm holding Gale, and the Reaper released its grip. The Reaper struck him backhand across the jaw. Something felt horribly loose on the left side of his head. Bone held only by skin sagged at the side of his face. Valentine blindly swung with the goad as he backpedaled. Then lost his balance. Clutched at Gale to keep from falling off. Valentine's vision cleared, and he saw, and worse, felt, the Reaper straddling him. The goad was gone. His pistol was gone. He put up a hand against the tongue, already licking out of the Reaper's mouth. It pulled his shirt open. Valentine groped at his belt. He had another cargo hook. Gale struck the Reaper across the back of its neck with her hands interlocked, but it ignored her the way it would a butterfly alighting. Valentine felt the pointed tongue probe at his collarbone. He brought up the cargo hook and buried the hook into the Reaper's jaw, returning pain for pain. He pulled, desperate, and the black-fanged mouth closed on its own tongue and severed it. It brought up its bad arm to try to pull the hook out, fumbling with the chain. Valentine pulled, hard, putting his back muscles into the effort, straining. God, how his jaw hurt as he gritted his teeth. The Reaper looking oddly like a hooked bass with eyes glazed and confused.
Hurt it bad enough, and the Currian shuts down the connection?
And the Reaper's jaw came free in a splatter of blood. The Reaper swung at his eyes, but Valentine got a shoulder up. He punched hard into the open wound at the bottom of its head and groped with his hand wrist deep in slimy flesh. He dug with fingers up the soft palate. The Reaper's eyes rolled back into its skull as Valentine squeezed the base of its brain like a sponge. Gale whacked it again, and it toppled off the back of the legworm. Valentine sucked in air and pain with each breath.
You look funny.
I bet I do.
Valentine examined his chest. The tiny wound from the Reaper's tongue had a splattering of Reaper blood all around it. It itched. He tore up some of the fiberglass-like legworm skin and blotted the tarry substance away. The legworm they rode waved its snout in the air as it hurried around the perimeter of the pushed-up earth. When it slowed to redescend into the pit, Valentine removed his first cargo hook, used it to lower Gale, and dropped off himself. He retrieved his goad and the other cargo hook. This time, she clung to him as he carried her, running for the telephone poles. Valentine heard voices and turned toward the sound.
I can't believe you used me as bait.
I got it, didn't I?
A second later and it would have popped my head off.
I never leave less than a second and a half to chance, sweetie. Wait!
It's us.
Valentine held his jaw as he spoke. He came into what might pass for a clearing, thick grasses rather than trees, around an old barn. The telephone poles lined a road like the Roman crucifixes on the Via Appia. Duvalier knelt down, working. Valentine stepped up and found what he expected, a headless Reaper.
Aw, hell, Val.
Rough night.
You should have seen it. The Reaper was coming for me. I tried to fire, but my gun was on safety, and before I could even flick off, it reached me. And there she was behind it.
Big tactic.
Duvalier examined the robe she had stripped off the Reaper for black and poisonous subcutaneous fluid.
Lying in the grass like a snake.
You're one of those... one of those hunter things.
You have a problem with that?
Others?
The others? I don't know. I didn't hear any screams.
Are there any more around?
Hope not.
Well, how do you know?
He knows. He just knows. Leave it at that.
Duvalier gave Valentine his rifle back, as though glad to give up an unpleasant burden.
Can we sleep soon? How about in that barn?
Attitude, Gale.
Stick the attitude. My feet are killing me.
I think she's getting better.
It took them a while to find the trail of Dr. Booth and Pepsa. Valentine found their marks in the long grasses. They'd cut over to a legworm trail and followed it up the hillside.
What are they going back in that direction for?
Valentine shrugged, resolved to communicate with hand signals.
Oh.
They started up the hill. They caught up to the pair, Booth hiking along behind Pepsa, carrying the gun in one hand, her medical bag slung. Valentine elbowed Duvalier, pointed, and made a T with his hands.
What's the matter?
Valentine found he could whisper coherently. He spoke into Duvalier's ear.
Something's wrong. Somebody's been giving us away.
Back in the Legworm Valley, Valentine heard two legworms and perhaps a dozen men on horseback. They looked like native Kentuckians intermingled with grogs.
Let's catch up!
They went up the hill as quickly as Gale's weary, unsteady legs would allow. The vets must have heard them coming. Both turned around. Pepsa looked frightened. Booth brought up the pistol and pointed it between them.
Shit. Guessed wrong. Why didn't I just shoot the pair of them? Because they might not be in it together.
Hey, Doc, it's us!
Guns! Drop them!
The gun shook in Booth's hands as she pointed. Tears streamed down her face.
Tears? Why would a Kurian agent cry?
Epsa!
Valentine sighted on the first Kurian agent he had ever looked upon. The U-gun burned. The agony of the steam in the Kurian tower redoubled and poured through his nervous system. A voice in his head spoke to him.
Don't think so.
Thatcher brought up his rifle.
What the hell?
The burning agony left, and Valentine felt relief and wonder at freedom from pain. But why was Thatcher shouldering his rifle with the barrel pressed to his collarbone and the butt pointed at Pepsa? Ah! Blood and bone flew from Thatcher's shoulder. Suddenly, Duvalier was out of the Kentucky grass, sword held up and ready.
Stupid blood!
Duvalier dropped her sword, jumped back from it as though it were a snake striking. Valentine grabbed his short legworm pick and lunged up the hill. Booth turned her gun at Pepsa. No, not at her, at a patch of dark shortleaf pine behind her, and fired. Valentine was still three strides away. When the pain came, the legworm pick lightning in his hands. No, fire, hot blue flame that burned.
Lies. They fight with lies. Lies can't change steel to flame.
Valentine raised the pick, fighting the pain with sound.
You dumb fuck terrorist!
And he threw, sent the pick spinning at her, saw the point bury itself in one fleshy breast. Then he went to Booth, took the hot gun from her shaking hand, pointed and fired. The gun clicked empty. Even as Pepsa toppled over, Valentine straddled her, hitting her with the pistol butt, silencing the scream from between his ears by caving in her skull. But nothingness yawned beneath him like a chasm. He felt himself tottering at the edge of an abyss. Duvalier picked him up off Pepsa's corpse, pulling him out of the darkness. Riders approached. Booth bent over Thatcher, applying pressure as Duvalier waved the riders over. Finally, the strange emptiness in Valentine's head left, and he could distinguish faces again.
Hello, Bulletproof! You're far from home. What hospitality can fellow tribesmen offer?
They bartered the Reaper's robe for transport and found their way back to the Bulletproof. In a few days, they again knew Kentucky hospitality in a chilly Z-shaped valley fed by artesian springs. Valentine's jaw was braced and bandaged with baling wire by Booth. Valentine learned to appreciate smashed cubes of legworm flesh, slathered in barbecue sauce, sucked through a straw. He also got mashed squash, pumpkin, and corn, eating out of the same pot as the resident babies. Once his jaw knit, he borrowed an old-fashioned horse, loaded up a second with grain and dried meat, and rode out to where he had last seen Anka. He left a stoppered bottle of bulletproof bourbon at grog eye level with a note to his friend, telling him where they were wintering until warmth allowed travel again. He tried to learn what had happened to Anka and his pursuing column, but only found some shattered glass and debris that might have been from a motorcycle 8 miles away. The fruitless search left him moody and depressed. His tender mouth troubled him every time he spoke and ate, and a fragment of mirror showed that his jawline now had an uneven balance to it, thanks to the break. The only bright spot was Gail Foster's transformation into a convivial, charming woman, though she remained a little pallid, even on the hearty bulletproof cooking. She looked as though she were about to have twins. He couldn't remember the last time he'd seen a woman with such a wide belly after the baby dropped. The baby came on December 22nd. Duvalier woke Valentine and passed him a hot cup of grassy-tasting tea.
Gail's water broke. Our vet is attending. Suki's there, too.
She brought him to a modest pellet stove heated home that served as a sick room for the local bulletproof. Suki was a bulletproof midwife. She was young, perhaps a year or two older than Valentine, but had a calming effect on Gail, brought about by nothing more than her quiet voice and cups of the honey-filled silvery tea she brewed. Valentine went in and saw Gail lying on her side with her knees drawn up and buttocks at the edge of the hammock-like birthing bed. He gripped her hand through a contraction, sponging the sweat from her forehead when it was over. She'd soaked through her shirt, even in the winter cool. Valentine wrung out the sponge.
I wish Will was here. He always...
Will never forgot about you for a moment. Your husband wasn't the man you thought. Or he was. You'll understand when you see him again.
She smiled and nodded.
First, we gotta get your baby into the world. Can do?
Can do.
She's quit dilating. I'm going to C-section. Suki, get me the tray laid out in the kitchen.
Valentine got out of the way as the midwife came in with the tray.
Suki, keep your chin up.
Booth poured a shot glass full of bulletproof, then added a couple of drops of ether to it. She tipped it into a fist-sized wad of cotton.
Have her breathe this.
She handed the mask to Suki.
Christmas baby. You are almost a Christmas baby.
Enough. Gail, keep looking at the ceiling. Over before you know it.
Valentine watched her focus on Gail's belly, steadying the scalpel. Valentine watched, relieved and fascinated at the same time, as the scalpel opened Gail just above the pelvis.
Coming now. Your baby's doing fine.
God, do they all look like that?
Booth pulled out a frog-like creature, narrow, legs drawn up tight, arms folded like a dead insect's. Brachycephalic skull all the more unreal as the doctor held it upside down.
Oh, Christ.
A baleful yellow eye, slit-pupiled, peered at him from a face pinched by internal agony. Gail Foster Post had given birth to a reaper. Suki backed away, hand over her mouth.
Boy or girl? What? What?
Booth showed her.
Get it away from me! Bastards! Lying bastards!
Stay still. Suki, put three more drops in another shot glass.
Give it to me.
Valentine extended a towel. He took the struggling infant, cleaned its sexless body.
What a mess. Tearing everywhere in the uterus. I hope I can fix this. Just pinch its nose and mouth shut. Buried outside.
Valentine took the infant out into the December air, instinctively holding it close against the chill. He looked at the blood-smeared face, purple and green and blue, crisscrossed with veins, horror in miniature. Black nails, impossibly tiny, gleamed wetly as it moved its hand.
Did yellow eyes make you evil? A pointed tongue?
Do you have a soul?
Valentine wondered if he'd directed the question to the newborn or to himself. Tiny nostrils, long little jaw. He could smother it one-handed.
My DNA is 98% identical to a chimpanzee. How much code do I share with you?
However much, a tiny amount of it was Kurian. Evil or Life Weaver. The Dao Weem and Dao Wa shared however many gene pairs they possessed, 30,000 or 3 million. They differed only in their opposition over vampirism. Could he say a creature fresh from the womb deserved to die, thanks to its appearance? Not appearance, design. A newborn, innocence embodied in what felt like 10 pounds of sugar, harmless. But experience told him otherwise. Songs of Innocence and Experience. William Blake.
Did he who made the lamb make thee?
Valentine closed up the towel, protecting the newborn tiger against the chill. The Reaper's head turned, sensing something it liked in Valentine's wrist. Valentine pushed his pulse point a little closer, offering. Its mouth opened, latched on, and Valentine felt the prick of the sharp tongue. The penetration only hurt a little. Softly, the Reaper fed. Vampire Earth, Book 5, Valentine's Exile, is a graphic audio production. Copyright 2007, Eric E. Frisch. Published by arrangement with Trident Media Group, LLC. All rights reserved. Production copyright 2011, The Cutting Corporation. All rights reserved. Performed by Ken Jackson, Tim Getman, Lily Beacon, Rick Rowan, Christopher Graybill, Scott McCormick, Joseph Thornhill, Kate Foster, Elizabeth Demery, Drew Copus, Daniel Gavigan, Mort Shelby, Terrence Aselford, Eric Messner, Elizabeth Jernigan, Karen Novak, Thomas Penny, Tom Simpson, Tim Carlin, Dylan Lynch, Nanette Savard, Sonny Lasky, Britt Herring, Nick DePinto, Sherry Simpson, Casey Platt, Thomas Keegan, Ren Casey, Yasmin Toison, Michael Glenn, David Coyne, Johann Detweiler, Barbara Pinolini, and Ted Stoddard. Book adapted for graphic audio by Matt Jacobs. Directed by Ken Jackson. Dialogue editing and sound design by Domestic Wooden. Additional music by Brian Patton, Nathaniel Perry, Dan Sondak, Johann Detweiler, and Chris Rowan. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. If you enjoy Vampire Earth, be sure to look for Night Angel Trilogy by Brent Weeks and the Vata's War series by Elizabeth Moon, available at Roadstops Everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net, where you'll also find samples of all our action-pumped titles, as well as free downloadable extras, forums, and podcasts.
If you can't find that graphic audio title you're looking for, go to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD format or digital download. If you're on the road, call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220. Or www.graphicaudio.net. And if you're looking for a great way to try out a different graphic audio series, check out our convenient and easy-to-store long-haul box sets, which contain up to 5 books of a series. Available only at www.graphicaudio.net. Be sure to sign up for our monthly newsletter or follow us on Twitter.